Welcome to the Error Bar, where neuroscience meets uncertainty. Welcome to the Error Bar. This is not a regular episode. I'm on holiday in Ireland. This, instead, is a bonus episode from our first discussion at the Error Bar with Dr. Ulrika Kuchner from University of Nottingham and Dr. Chris Taylor from the New England College of Medicine. We talked about why there are no green stars in astronomy and how that might be interpreted in human colour perception. These are the relatively unedited conversations we had. As the nights are getting darker again in the Northern Hemisphere and the stars are coming out, I hope this conversation is of interest. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with a regular episode about brain science news. But until then, over to Ulrika. Welcome to the Error Bar, and would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, sure. Thank you. My name is Ulrike Kuchner. I am a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Nottingham. I'm an astrophysicist in the School of Physics and Astronomy. And I study how galaxies evolve in the universe and how the large-scale structure in the universe came to be. That's not all of it. I also have a background in fine arts. So I'm an artist as well, and I make art and I curate art in this intersection called art science.
Excellent. Well, it's great to have you here. Do you need a drink?
Oh, yes, please. Yes, please. Are we okay with a martini?
Martini works.
Gin martini, then.
What brings you to the Error Bar?
Well, I hear that really interesting questions are being discussed here, and I am a creature of curiosity. Excellent. Let's discuss.
Cool. So, yeah, one of the reasons I started this place was because about a year ago, I read this tweet from Jim Al-Khalili, a physicist and a science journalist, and he said, science tells us there are no green stars. And it puzzled me, and I thought, oh, there must be green stars. And I thought that was also a psychological question rather than a physics question. So, yeah, I want there to be green stars. So maybe you can tell me why Jim Al-Khalili said there are no green stars.
I like that you want them to be there. Well, first of all, it's such a good question because it sounds really simple, but it's really multi-layered. There's so many aspects to it. So I guess for the physics layer, we can back up a bit and just discuss stars and the fact that they come in all colors, all kinds of colors, but more precisely from the outer layer of the star. And that is based on its temperature. So it's a really important feature, the color of the star. We know that bluer stars are hotter and redder stars are colder, for example, which is a little bit backwards, but that's how it is. I actually imagine always a flame from a normal candle and closer to the wick, it's bluer, and then it's white, and then yellow, and then red, kind of like stars. So the temperature is related to the kinetic energy, so the motion of the particles and the mass of the star. We really know a lot from the color. We already can infer the mass and the temperature. But all objects emit light at all wavelengths, and that is from radio to high energy, like X-rays and gamma rays. But the overall statistical distribution of it that describes all that light, that's close to this black body curve, which is like a smooth curve that peaks at a certain wavelength but has a really long tail as well. So, for example, cool bodies like you and I, we peak in the infrared, but most of the stars, like our sun, peak in the visible, in the optical light, which is really good for us to dream and to look at the stars. So, and that also means that we can actually see them with our eyes. That's the actual issue here. They are not so sensitive to all the parts of the spectrum, and we don't see the exact wavelength of the light entering our eyes. So we have blue, red, and green sensors, these cones in our eyes, that each cover a range of wavelengths. So when the light hits these cones, they send a signal to the brain where then the color gets interpreted. So all the colors that we see are made up of these three colors, but that's signal doesn't correspond to one single wavelength, it's a mix. And so a mix of all three of them is white. Now back to the stars, if we have a reddish star, that distribution of the black body curve peaks in the red area of that distribution. So we see it as reddish. If we go to hotter stars, then they become orange and yellow and then white, not green. And that is because that peak is, yes, it does peak in the green, but it also includes what's left and right of it, which is red and blue. And so it's actually a mix of all these three colors, and we kind of see this mix as white. And then as it goes even hotter, that curve shifts to the blue side, and we see the bluish colors of the really hot, massive stars. I think that is the mystery.
Okay. Well, it's disappointing there's no green stars. So I guess one thing I found an old book of mine at home, and there was this picture of the spectral classes, and they'd used greeny colors to illustrate the spectral classes. Do you think it's just a convenient shorthand to say that the middly ones are sort of greenish, or did they once upon a time really think there were green stars?
Once upon a time in the 1980s. I think perhaps they did that out of simplicity, because as we know now, this is a complex problem that involves the human biology and as well as the physics. So perhaps they just wanted to stick to the one discipline in that book and not make it more complicated. But one thing that I will say is that even now we don't have the exact accurate representation in our visualizations. And that is simply because in all those diagrams that we're creating, we're basing them on, or the colors on, this smooth black body curve rather than on the actual stellar spectrum that has all the wiggles in it. So a more precise stellar spectrum template would create a little bit different color code, which actually shows that there aren't really, really red stars. So they're more orangey, yellow, and then kind of like, so our sun is a white, not green, white, not yellow star. And then there's lots of different shades of blue.
Is it just stars, or do whole galaxies or clusters or nebulae, are they green at all? Is there any green out there?
I mean, yes and no. So I study galaxies, and galaxies are just made up of many, many billions of stars. And since most of the light in a galaxy does come from this population of stars, if most of the stars in there are red, then the galaxy will appear red. So if we look at the many billions of galaxies out there, we see this bimodality. We have either those red or those blue galaxies, and they tell us, as I said already, about their evolutionary status and whether they're massive or young or old, and it's really important. And we think that there is an evolution that goes from the blue with the young massive stars in it to the red galaxies that are older and more passive. And as they do this, they transition and change their makeup. And we call those the Green Valley galaxies. But they aren't actually green, but they're called green. So the nebulae, etc., that color tells us, if you think of these beautiful images where you see a green glowing nebula, that tells us about the composition or the elements in the gas of this nebula. So if it excites in a very specific wavelength that is at the frequency where green is, then this is the actual color of it, yes. And we tease that out of the image by putting filters on it that are just picking up that narrow wavelength range. But our eyes cannot do that, but scientific instruments can.
So when normal non-astrophysicists are looking at stars, they go out into the night and they look up, and they might be dark adapted, but there'll be lots of light pollution, and they probably don't have a very good telescope. So when astrophysicists talk about color, what situations are they really describing? Are they talking about on a computer screen or with the naked eye?
We are usually talking about computer screens or numbers or values that relate to colors. But the images, or spectra for that matter, that are taken by professional astronomers, these are taken in telescopes that are placed in areas where it's very dark, where the air is very calm, no pollution nearby. So these are excellent seeing conditions. In fact, the best is, of course, to leave the Earth's atmosphere altogether and observe from space. But these modern telescopes collect the light to the CCD cameras or the spectrographs. And these cameras on the telescopes are so digital recordings or digital readings of how bright something is. So that's an absolute measure of the light that has hit the CCD chip. And so we have a pixel-to-pixel information of how much light hit that particular spot. And then the spectrograph splits up the light and we have even more information. But we then put filters that block wavelength ranges and just take the same image through different filters, and that gives us some color information. So there are broadband filters that reflect these broad green or broad blue light, but there are also these very narrow filters that really look at interesting individual areas where some emission might happen. So a color is really subtracting one image through one filter by another image through another filter.
And are there like philosophical schools that are like the purists who want to keep the color one way and some avant-garde people who want to change the color another way? Is there any schools of thought on
color just reflects the area in the wavelength ranges, and so that and instruments can obviously be sensitive also in the UV and the X-ray, you know, so much more than our little visible range, which is tiny in comparison to all the other wavelengths that are available. And then we just try to make them visible and understandable to us, but I think that's pretty standard, so I don't know if there are avant-garde ways of someone coming in and trying to find something completely different. Doesn't really happen often in science.
Hey, you talked about atmospheric pollution and getting the best viewing conditions. Is that why the stars twinkle?
Not just pollution, but because the atmosphere is just not stable. So we have all these layers that are moving. And so the light that comes through it just jiggles and bounces and breaks. And so that's why the single point that should be the star is changing brightness and position very quickly, and so to us that looks like twinkling, so it's pretty annoying.
I was looking at Sirius the other day through my lovely brand new telescope, and it was definitely orange and blue at the same time, and then I defocused the telescope and there was definitely some green shimmering twinkly in there. But I guess that's just is it aberration, or it's like imperfections in everything that's just splitting up the color? Is that
I'm not so sure about the green twinkle, but I would guess that because you have, you know, the optics in your telescope as well, that it's all a bit the imperfections. Seemed that you liked it, so.
Yeah, it was quite pretty. It was sort of shimmering and changing color. It's very nice.
Yeah, there is this phenomenon, the green flash. People are looking out at beautiful sunsets. Actually, I have been at the VLT, the Very Large Telescope in Chile, with some staff astronomers there who were standing outside looking at the sunsets. Is it going to be with the green flash or not? So that's a really, I think it's a rare, very brief moment where you have a tiny flash of green when all the other blue and reds are absorbed and not seen. I have not seen one, but I would love to see a green flash.
So it's out there.
That is out there. Yes, that's when the other wavelengths are just blocked by Earth or by the atmosphere.
That's good news. So one problem which your colleague Dr. Megan Gray pointed out was that a lot of astrophysicists are male, and color vision deficiency is more common in men. So how do you as a community get around the problem of having quite a high proportion of people who can't see all the same colors?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. It is true that there is a problem in our field that there's an underrepresentation of non-males. So it's about 20% female currently that have permanent professory positions. Yeah, is it 10% or so of the male population that is colorblind? In fact, my PhD supervisor was colorblind, or he still is colorblind. So I guess I was trained to look at for that a bit. It's actually really easy to get around it, but it doesn't happen enough. So you can just plot, instead of using colors, use different patterns and labels and shapes. There are wonderful websites out there to help you make your plots colorblind friendly. There are simulators where you can just see what that's like. Not so many people are printing anymore, but it's always a good check to see if you can distinguish what you want to say in a black and white print. So I would hope that it's known by now that we have to take care of this, but it's not as much as it should. Yeah, I think there are even websites where you can upload your whole paper and have it checked for these things.
So it'll airbrush out all the green stars and replace them with...
No, I mean, also the color schemes of the biggest Python tools and Matplotlib and Pandas and these things, they have updated to being colorblind friendly. So the default now for these more commonly used languages for visualizations are taking that into account.
Can you tell us a bit more about the interface between physics and art? Do you think it gives you some advantage in trying to plot or describe or perceive the universe or represent it?
It's a shame that we only have a few minutes left, because I love that topic. The interface between art and science, it's such a big topic. And where to even begin, because, you know, they have obviously a relationship to one another, but seem to play these very different roles in our human experience. Often this relationship for the scientists has been perceived a bit as art in the service of science rather than a real collaboration. So the artists are rarely considered co-authors, for example. That makes it all really difficult. I mean, transdisciplinary, interdisciplinary work is very difficult, and we have to understand each other's history and prejudice and biases, etc., that goes both ways. And the communication between these two worlds is really not a given. But I think because we're having such complex problems to solve, it's really important to try such transdisciplinary collaborations. I think important and urgent problems that cannot be solved by one discipline alone, like open research is one of them. Here, the freedom and art of art and science is really on the line. So these two working together is very powerful. But you actually ask whether you think I have a unique perspective. And I mean, don't we all have some kind of unique perspective? We all come to creating knowledge with our own historical background. And so mine just happened to be art. The problem or the crux is that we're supposed to deliver science in this very stripped down, sobering way. So art really has that opportunity to deliver the emotions and make it unique to the perceiver or beholder. So it is very powerful, but whether I'm in a unique position is hard for me to answer.
And what would you do to encourage artists and scientists to work better together?
Well, there are really different ways to work together, and like a cooperation can be established through common methods or a cooperation. Subject area is similar, but practically, I think it's really important to learn a bit about the other discipline. So understand where their history, understand, you know, what their unique advantages are. For me personally, so I was studying art and astronomy at the same time, and then was using the same data for my master's in art as well as for my master's in astronomy. And it really helped me to understand or to grasp the problem. And so understanding is a pretty big part in the kind of research that we're doing. We're not creating anything other than knowledge. So to help other people in this understanding process, and if art can do that, and I'm convinced art can do that, that is the key of a good collaboration there. The fact that for art, emotions are their language, and this is something that science cannot use. This is the unique path together to use the bread and butter for art that emotions is, and make the other people truly understand and care about this thing that science does that is sort of only understood by a small group of other scientists. The tricky bit, and I haven't fully understood how to get around it, is that art science is very often used for outreach by the scientists. And art science is very much an independent practice of art. And so it kind of starts at the basics to understand what each can get out of it. And that's something that I'm still exploring.
So we really need people with both qualifications in art and science subjects like yourself.
Well, either that or people that know how to translate and communicate between the two.
And I guess finally, I watched your video, your great video, Do I Disturb the Universe? And you talked in there how you've used errors and mistakes from instruments and cameras to create projects around. The Error Bar loves errors. It's, you know, why we're here to talk about mistakes mm-hmm. and what we can learn from them. But yeah, do you have a view on the role of errors in your work?
Yeah, I mean, I love this topic. Do I dare disturb the universe? So I'm thinking a lot about how we respond to errors and uncertainties and how we deal with mistakes and weaknesses. But if we know that even the best telescopes and the best instruments make mistakes and forgive them, maybe we can understand ourselves a little bit better. Well, this fascination, I guess, with errors in the sciences, and also in all these images that we create and that I talked about a little bit, we try to remove, of course, the errors, or the instrumental errors that we need to clean with all these calibration images. And that makes a lot of sense. But I loved the idea of just keeping them as they are, keeping those imperfections and reflect on those. And we try to always find patterns in the noise and make sense, even if it's just complete random noise. But if there's a little thing in there that's not supposed to be there in a bias frame, we immediately look at that and, oh, that is interesting. That's a little dead pixel in there. I think it's just giving some space to reflect. And that's my favorite kind of art, is art that invites you to meditate and reflect this back to you, and also to question what the truth is, I guess. Question, as imperfect humans, our little simplified understanding of the universe with the limits that we have.
And are there any personal errors or mistakes that you want to confess to?
Loads.
We can offer, you know, we can offer, what's the word, forgiveness at the error bar. Anything you want to admit to? What's your biggest mistake, maybe, or your most interesting one?
No, I don't think I have a good answer for that to get in a podcast.
Or a scientifically interesting mistake.
I mean, as I confessed earlier, I am terrified of making mistakes publicly. And I'm, you know, reading and listening to people like, I think it was Neil Gaiman who said, make more mistakes, brave big ones and embrace them. I really would like to just stand on a platform and say, look at that, I did that. I'm not quite there yet. So I'll invite you when I'm there to announce my big blunder and say.
Perfect. And is there anything else you want to say about anything?
I guess maybe to just acknowledge that our modern society deals with concepts that are really difficult to understand and to grasp, that are complex and wicked, and that we maybe not have all the answers if you look at one discipline, but just ask around. Look who else might have answers. Yeah, artistic ones could be, creative, philosophical ones could be in there to find a holistic picture.
Well, good. For a neuroscience podcast, the first guest, not being a neuroscientist, I think we're trying, or I'm trying to do that, I think. Welcome to the Error Bar. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Christopher Taylor from the New England College of Optometry, located in Boston's Back Bay. I work chiefly in the field of what's known as emmetropization, or how you grow an eyeball to match the power of the optics so you don't need things like glasses and contacts. So that's what I'm working on now, but I've worked on things such as aging and vision and spatial vision and temporal vision for going on 20 years now since I was an undergrad. So I'm really feeling it. It makes me feel like I need a drink.
Yeah. What can I get you?
You know, hearing that, those dulcet British tones makes me really yearn for a real ale. Real ale. I haven't had a real ale. I can't get a good real ale here in Boston since...
This'll do.
This'll do, yes. Yes, definitely.
It's a real coincidence you've dropped in, because we were just talking about color perception with an astrophysicist. So I think I could have a few questions for you.
All right.
In a sentence, how do we perceive color?
Sentence, how do we perceive color?
Yeah.
Well, it starts with a photon. Usually more than one photon that will excite one of two classes of detectors known as photoreceptors, either rods and cones. This is way more than one sentence. But that's the easy bit. But the brain is continually taking that physical property of wavelength and using it to determine not only the relative colors of objects, but take out the color of the illumination. And the brain's trying to give us the best interpretation of the wavelengths that are coming off an individual surface to give us the color of an object. In a sentence, it's really complicated, but it requires mechanisms all the way up from the retina through to the visual cortex. It's a huge matter of interpreting wavelength into even words and language, which influences color perception. In addition to memory as well. One of my favorite tidbits of color is that we think we can see a whole rainbow of colors and discriminate them very finely. Your ability to discriminate colors side by side is much, much better. You can discriminate millions of colors, but if you introduce a delay, it goes down to just a few dozen or 20, unless you're an expert. Color is simple yet complicated at the same time.
Well, I didn't know the temporal delay thing.
Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. So this is why it's good to have you here, because I've been speaking to astrophysicists and they're dealing with the wavelength, the pattern of wavelengths, and what kind of things that all things emit, what kind of energy that emits. And for them, there are no green stars or yellow or cyan or purple. And that for me as a psychologist just sounded a bit too neat. So any initial thoughts on the color of stars?
Yeah, that they're confused by the trickery of psychology by using color names instead of the precision of wavelength. That which is understandable, because you don't want to go around saying that there are no stars that emit chiefly radiation in the 500 to 700 nanometer band. So you say there's no green stars. And that's it's a really common error, I think, just to believe that color is just out there rather than the brain constructing the world. So the whole factoid of that there are no green stars is a really neat one, and does say something special in particular about the universe. But it's also an interesting point about how scientific communication can delight yet mislead sometime and give the illusion of understanding.
Okay, so color perception is complex. I think we get that. But let's break it down. So I'm thinking of stargazing and astronomers are going out at night, you know, with a red torch and dark adapting and then looking at the stars. But astrophysicists are looking through telescopes or computers. So what happens when it gets dark to your color vision?
First bit is in the first 8 minutes, the cones will adapt. So that one type of photoreceptor that we see detail with and we see color cheaply with. And once those are adapted after 8 minutes, they aren't sensitive enough to catch light efficiently anymore. And then the rods that have bigger apertures and more sensitive photopigments will start to dominate. And those will kick in. At that point, the rods will continually get more and more sensitive as they start to dominate. A really interesting bit about just regular stargazing is that in the central vision, where we tend to look and have our most detailed vision, doesn't contain any rods. So when going out into the night, it's better to look slightly off from any faint star object that you're looking to see. So that's a very common thing that stargazers sort of know in the lore. If you want to see a faint star, look slightly to the left or to the right. And that's chiefly due to that those rods aren't there present in the fovea. Not just the complexity, it's that it takes the brain with color is always doing its that trick of comparing the physical input among its sensors. It's a really big trick with cone and color perception, because if you look at the response of any of the different, instead of red, green, and blue, let's call them long, medium, and short wavelength cones, they have very wide ranges of responses to different wavelengths of light. So if you hit a medium or green cone with red light, it's going to respond quite well. So narrowband light, aside from some of the shortest wavelengths, will stimulate all the short, medium, and wavelength cones in addition to the rods. And given that we're talking about adaptation and different times of days and night, really, it's a bit of an aside and a tangent, is the time around dawn and dusk. You can get to light levels where both the rods and cones are active. And this is well known in the film and television industries of the golden hour. But that's when humans can see all the both the rod vision and the cone vision. And so we're functionally tetra, or have four receptors instead of trichromatic. So everyone often comments on how beautiful things look, but it's probably because of that mere addition of the rods playing a role in perception at that time.
I had my wedding photos done at that time of day, and yeah, they look great. And we were walking across a field and the sun was going down, and yeah, it was very special.
it's all vision perception sort of takes the magic of that.
You're unweaving the rainbow for me.
Speaking of rainbow, the whole issue of, well, there's definitely no purple stars, things like that. If that's said, purple is a mixture of short and long wavelengths. So it's what's known as a non-spectral hue. So one of those colors that you can't create if you have a tunable light, let's say, that you can vary the wavelength of it. You can't get purple. You need both red and blue, which is one of those amazing factoids that blew my mind in intro perception, that purple is a non-spectral hue.
So a star and all like radioactive bodies emit really broad band, and the color of stars is like, it's just a slight shift in the distribution within the visible range. But I'm thinking, if, because a star is like a point of light billions of miles away, could that point just stimulate, say, a green cone and then a red cone and then a blue one, and you would see, would you see green and then red and then blue?
Yeah, I was kind of anticipating your question with the broadness of those responses and the comparisons. I was sort of getting ahead of myself there in thinking it. So if you hit a green cone with a red light, it will just signal, I have caught some photons. So people who use systems with mirrors that are flexible, called adaptive optics, can do what's known as single cone psychophysics and stimulate single cones. And having been in one of those machines and as a subject, you can stimulate a green cone with red light. And because you're just activating that one cone, there's not that ability to compare the activity across photoreceptors. So my experience of that was of a whitish light. So it really hammers home that point that it's the entire system, not the receptors themselves, that are driving the perceptive color. So just hitting that green cone with long wavelength light, that medium wavelength sensitive cone, will just say, hey, I see some photons. And then that gets passed up as what is perceived as a white flash. You would really need to get that vivid sensation of green, get the red cones deactivated with green light, with a green cone activated with green light in a sort of a what's known as a center surround organization, where one type of cone is being inhibited versus a cone that's being excited. So that's that contrast, that comparison, that's really generating that color signal.
The trick with the mirrors is to stabilize the light, right? Because the eye is always jiggling around and moving, and presumably the optics of everyday life are not very good. So there's scratches on your glasses, or everything's wobbling. So is that the problem, that, or not the problem, but maybe it's adaptive, that when things wobble around, you actually see a lot better?
Yeah, I would say so. The whole system's tuned for things being in constant motion. Yeah, and those adaptive optic systems will take into account any imperfections in the eye shaking about a little bit. And those same systems can take pictures of people's photoreceptor arrays. And one thing that came out of that work done by David Williams at Rochester and Austin Roeder at Berkeley is how individually variable people's photoreceptor mosaics are. One person can have a retina with many, many more medium wavelength cones than long wavelength cones, and another completely the reverse. Yet, if you drop them into a behavioral experiment, they'll be entirely consistent in what they call red between one another. So that photoreceptor mosaic, somehow, despite massive individual differences, and I remember seeing those pictures for the first time, thinking, how does the brain even make sense of seeing it all? Just is able to wire itself up and extract those signals in a consistent way. You know, obviously there are some behavioral individual differences, but the anatomy, when it's visualized and imaged, is just astoundingly different. It's, you know, the engineers, whoever built those, must have had one too many real ales at those times.
Yeah, that's I've seen some of those mosaic pictures, and yeah, I just thought it couldn't be true. Are these unique individuals? How much variability is there between, say, just the normal population?
I don't have a quantitative number at my fingertips, but those initial images that were published 15 to 20 years ago are not atypical in their first small sample of subjects. So having see one observer with a green dominated retina versus a red cone dominated retina. There are massive individual differences in the cone mediation in the retina. What kind of saves the issue in the end is if you look at the green and the red cones, responses to wavelengths of light, is that they're very close. Their sensitivities overlap greatly. And their peak sensitivity is only separated by about 30 nanometers, which is very small. So in a way, perhaps the system can utilize that there's something slightly interchangeable about what they are, and that we're just signaling differences in the spectral output rather than using those sensor signals to signal wavelength. So what that comes out as is the coarser perception of color and looking for differences in those spectra.
Does the same apply to the rare cases of people with four cone receptors? Is right, tetrachromacy, is it?
Yes, yeah. So those color anomalous individuals with four, they're pretty rare. And even those individuals who we think of as red-green color blind aren't usually missing a photoreceptor type. It's just instead of that 30 nanometer separation, there's a little bit less of a separation between the medium and long wavelength cone. And well, there are some extremely rare individuals who do lack the gene for, let's say, short wavelength cones or one of the others, color anomalous, and individuals in terms of lacking a photoreceptor will have those cones closer together, and those tetrachromats will have what the anomalous individual has plus the normal version. So they have those photoreceptors packed in really tightly all around that range of that 530-ish nanometers, which is the peak. So whether those tetrachromatic observers, whether that has any functional use or anything other than something you can observe in the lab, is a question that I don't think is quite resolved, or it's something that's probably not harmful enough for evolution to select out, either in the deleterious case, which is generally males, or the tetrachromatic case, which is generally females, who carry that mutant X gene, whereas in males, just having the mutant gene will cause that smaller separation between the M and L cones. I have to mention my friend the chicken, who has a UV cone. So chickens are used in vision research, particularly those questions surrounding color and eye growth. And they do have a fourth cone that sees into the UV. This is true for many birds that often use it for sexual selection or mating. And they also have a cone type that has both the green and red photopigment together in one photoreceptor unit that senses luminance overall. So despite the photopigments being preserved pretty well in molecularly across evolution all the way back to avian branch of the tree, the solutions that nervous systems and organisms come up with have been really interesting.
So. I feel like you need a philosopher to go along with color perception research, because it sounds like it's not an easy, straightforward scientific question. Like, why is it that complete massive differences in cone types or cone densities cannot lead to any change in behavior in normal, you know, that seems like a philosophical question.
Yeah, I think a philosophical question, or that I would reach for the fact that there's so many pressures on behaving the right way, that if it were these small differences in anatomy truly mattered, they'd be selected out right quick. But yeah, the philosophers, in terms of, there's the famous experiment of Mary being raised with one color. Would she see colors if she was introduced from in a room that had colors? It's a fun thought experiment that the philosophers like to throw out. And you probably need a linguist too to distinguish all this, because there's the cross-cultural research where, might miss the mark here, but I believe the Italians have greater distinctions in the short wavelengths, the different two commonly used words for blues are a green blue and a blue, that are, of course, English has a variety of color words, but it's the frequencies of which these words are used vary from language to language. And linguists will analyze, well, how many unique colors can folks name? And they're far more than one would predict, just based on the anatomy, I think.
It's So that brings us right back to your the start of this, where you you said, you sort of implied that to say the star is green is it's almost like a linguistic mistake. Mm-hmm. It's kind of thing a philosopher might say. So it's just a helpful rule of thumb for people to communicate with each other about patterns they observe. Is that too philosophical? What am I asking?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's worthwhile. It's color at once is so fundamental and so common, yet you dig into it psychophysically and anatomically or physiologically, we're at once super sensitive to it, yet we get to this point where we can just name a few shades and that's our rainbow. So, you know, it's at once this crucial property, but our system is exquisitely sensitive to, but at the same time, we categorize and really need to make quick decisions about, is that berry red? Is that berry blue? It's a big, big topic. I think it's a point worth making. It's the saying there are no green stars seems striking to say at first, but when you dig into the details about black body radiation and things like that, it's saying something quite different from what we mean when we're talking about color in a human context.
Yeah, your time is up. That's
good. As long as we don't have to talk about the dress.
No. So.
Yes. <that's>,
yeah. I think it's a big trick. I think there's like half the world has been paid off to say. Anyway, let's not go there.
Well, I can make it flip, but that's
all right. That's good. It's just different regions of the. I think I can. Yeah, some of them I can flip, but others not. Anyway.
Yeah, it's that.
The luminance. Does it depend on? We're talking about the dress. That's not.
Yeah. Yes. But I don't know that. To me, that was all solved by Helmholtz and is in conscious inference.
Okay.
And so it's like, but whatever gets perception and vision to the BDS.
that's our job here. Yeah. So is there anything else you want to, nuggets you haven't disclosed, do you want to stick in for the record?
You talked about defocusing a telescope.
Yeah, so I tried. I looked at a star, defocused it. To the eye, it was bluey white with a bit of orange, an occasional twinkle of orange. But then when I defocused it, the twinkle slowed down a lot. And then there was sort of like a radial motion. It was pretty, but it was like definitely green and red and blue and yellow, orange, all the colors.
Yeah. That's digging back into our memory banks to Newton and his prism, glass will bend light and short wavelength will focus in front of medium wavelength light. Further back, and that difference in focus, it's there in the eye itself, and it's the reason why I brought it up again. It's also thought to be perhaps one of the signals that the eye is using to grow to the appropriate length, this longitudinal chromatic aberration. So instead of getting blue focused on the retina from that LCA signal or short wavelength focused on the retina, that's a signal that the eye is too short, that you're a baby, you're born with eyes that are too small, blue's too sharp, your eye should grow. If red starts to be too in focus, that's a signal to slow down and stop growing. And that's one of the sort of competing theories for why more and more folks, particularly in Asia, are needing glasses, because we're looking at light sources that have too much long wavelength light in them. So that is tricking the eyes into thinking that they should grow rather than hitting that mid wavelength target. Yeah, that you could put a lens and defocus a white star and make it be perceived as chiefly green makes a lot of sense. And it's related to some important notions in the work in basic developmental physiology of eye development. So
it's a lot of neat tricks and findings in color vision. It's really not simple.
Yeah. One of my, I guess as the last little favorite thing is one of my little favorite things in terms of a psychophysical setup or paradigm is with a regular computer monitor, you can, with some careful photometric measurements and some coding, get it to display a paradigm that's known as silent substitution. And silent substitution aims to have just one cone type more active than the others. And it does this in the following way. So it adjusts the type of wavelength output of your monitor such that medium and long are about equal in activation of those cones, but not short, so that only the short wavelength cones can see, say, a spot of light on the screen. And you can use this paradigm to see, well, how much activation relative to some set level of activation of the other two cones do you need to detect short wavelength stimuli in this paradigm, or medium wavelength, or red. And using this paradigm, one of my colleagues long before I met him found that in terms of the efficiency, that is, like, how much physical information do you need to detect this decrement or increment in cone activation, it's one of the most efficient tasks that humans can do. So we're really good at picking up those slight changes in cone activation, with the caveat that all the cones are activated, but just slight changes in their relative activation, which again speaks to that exquisite sensitivity to differences in activation rather than absolute activations. It's sort of one of those neat things with a carefully calibrated screen and a photometer and a practiced observer. You can get some really interesting results of what the visual system's attuned to. And it has one of the better titles of a paper out there called "What is the Color is What the Eye Sees Best?" So by Ray Eskew and his colleagues. One of my favorites, and it's great to work with him. How does the astrophysicist defend themselves by saying that there are no green stars?
I think it's just relying on just the very basics of human color perception. I don't think they've incorporated the problems. I don't know how. I'm going to have to think about this, actually. I guess that's what struck me about the original tweet from this physics guy, who's a great science communicator.
Yeah.
It's just that he said, "Oh, I learned a new fact today. There's no green stars." And that's not a fact. That's like, show me the psychophysical evidence that no one ever sees any green in stars. And what do you mean? Like, it's very contextual. And I wanted some rough edges and some noise and some uncertainty on that estimate.
Yeah,
yes. Because I'm, think there are green things out there. And then, so I think when you push them and say, well, what about in this condition? What about in that condition? They'll say, yeah, there's green things that people see as green. So there's this, Ulrika was telling me about when the sun goes down.
Oh, the green flash, yeah.
Oh, green flare. Flash, okay. Yeah, yeah, so she's never seen it. I've never seen it. But
Florida is good for it. Where VSS is located is pretty good view.
There we go, the green flare. So there are all these astrophysical phenomena which are either artificially colored green for clarity of communication, or there's green things happening, or there's the simultaneous color contrast where they say, oh, if you see a green star, it's only because there's a red one next door. It's not really green. And then,
that's what really green is.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's what sort of got my hackles up. And I just wanted to, So I think it's purely just, that's where they stop thinking about it, because they've done their job. They've got all the wavelengths they need. They can analyze the radio waves and the X-rays and all that stuff. And I just think they stop at when the light goes into the eye. But that's fair enough. And that's our job. And that's why psychophysics is such a good discipline, because it does the psycho part.
Yes. Yeah. I always liked one of my, Doug Creelman of signal detection theory fame, said that our job is between figuring out the dash between stimulus and response in SR psychology.
That's good.
Yeah. I'm very happy to be investigating that dash. But yeah, it's a nice little statement that I think there are things, and that statement falls in that bundle of sticky facts that give the Allison Sekulers that teach students the illusion of understanding, and then they can go unpack the illusion. And that's some of those things. There are no green stars. Well, someone's going to run into them and say, well, what do you mean by green?
Yeah, that's someone pesky. Like, yeah. Okay.
But then astrophysicists, that's how careers are born. It's like, well, what does this green mean? It's funny that if it's beside a red star and it looks green, it's not really green.
Yeah, that's on the Wikipedia page. And I think after I've edited this and produced it, I'm going back to that Wikipedia page and I'm editing it.
yes, that is really.
But yeah, it's just right there in verbatim. Like, yeah. If you see a green star, it's not really green. It's only because it's next to a red one. You know, that's fine. problem solved. It's just an illusion.
Yes. That's how we got the word green. Yes.
All right. Yeah. Oh, there's a final bit. I'm trying to work on an outro format, getting people to admit their mistakes. We can offer an absolution for any of your science sins. Is there anything you want to own up to?
Oh, sins. I saw this because I like this when you mentioned this. My thoughts immediately went to the seven deadly sins, and one of which being, I am not an expert, but sloth, as far as I can tell. Sloth in writing up data. That's more stale data out there that should be in the hands, at least of a preprint. So I don't know if I want to be absolved of that, but maybe to sign me a few Hail Marys in citations.
I think a few Bloody Marys should probably.
Much better.
Should probably do it.
That's the worst one that I can think of. Perhaps it's a virtue in the end, maybe. Hopefully the forgiveness takes the frame of better writing, better papers that go through less review and revision. Oh, do I really have to say my most important part of the brain? I'm just kidding. It's V1. So the biggest historical error in brain science, and I think it's the debate over localization of function, Lashley and those folks, that probably really got folks tied up into seeing some sort of importance about mapping versus figuring out networks of function. Oh, and scientific errors that annoy me the most. the table one fallacy, which I'm happy to say that the European Journal of Neuroscience now explicitly tells people not to do, is to do null hypothesis significance testing on people's demographic data. That should be better known.
And that has a name, the table one fallacy?
Yeah, Guillaume Rousselet named it the table one fallacy, which I'm hoping to make a thing. That and using error bars when you could use a box plot or individual data points.
Don't say anything against error bars.
the Box and Whisker podcast.
And column charts. And only today I made a video for my students of how to make a lovely column, a bar, and put a nice error bar on the top. Little goals. And then I also did an advanced video on showing all the data points.
Yes.
Little steps. But the table one fallacy, that could be a good episode.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. It's Guillaume is the editor there, or an editor there, an action editor. And because of my association with clinicians, I'll often get clinically focused papers sent my way. And he has boilerplate with links that says why he should remove these p-values from this table one. He likes dark beer, so maybe if he got him over to dark. No, the most exciting brain science around at the moment, I would say anything can, despite its buzz, anything connectome, especially the connectome of the retina, to get at that problem of individual differences in the photoreceptor mosaic. I think some really interesting stuff could come out of that. And it's really buzzy, so I'm almost embarrassed to point that out as the most exciting. But I think I would, if someone were able to hand over how that connectome resolves the individual differences to get it to a single point, we would really learn something that in vision, at least.
It's closing time at the Error Bar, but do drop in next time for more brain news, fact-checking, and neuro opinions. Take care. The Error Bar was devised and produced by Dr. Nick Holmes from the University of Nottingham. The music by Di Yang Ki is available from the Free Music Archive. Find us at theerrorbar.com, on Twitter at barerror, or email talk@theerrorbar.com.